That's Jim Pepper, saxophonist or saxophonist, whichever way you pronounce it, composer and singer of Kaw and Creek heritage. Beginning in the 1960s, he became a pioneer of fusion jazz. His band, the Free Spirits, credited as the first to combine elements of jazz and rock. His primary instrument was tenor saxophone, although he also played the flute. Jazz trumpeter Don Cherry and Ornette Coleman on saxophone, as you know, encouraged Pepper to reflect his roots and heritage and incorporate them into his jazz playing and composition. We just heard the opening to Lakota Song from his album Comin' and Goin'. Jim Pepper died on February the 10th, 1992, of lymphoma. He was 51 years old. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Friday, October the 3rd, and we're talking today about First Nations and the Nation, sovereignty and U.S. land and treaty law. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder last Friday officially signed off on a record $554 million settlement with the Navajo Nation that brought to an end a slew of lawsuits over the government's alleged mismanagement of the Navajo Nation's land use funds and its natural resources for decades. Apart from avoiding huge litigation costs on both sides, the settlement is justice for past wrongs, Holder said. The Navajo and other First Nations have several other lawsuits in litigation and pending. The settlement, though, raises a seldom explored issue. What is the nature of the relationship between First Nations and the United States government? Our guest today is Professor Charles Wilkinson, professor of law at the University of Colorado at Boulder, whose 14 books include the standard law texts on public land law, and on Indian law, as it's called, and he's here to discuss this complex relationship within the framework of treaties, sovereignty, conflicting worldviews, and the quest for justice. And I welcome you, Professor Wilkinson, to Lead Stories today.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be talking with you. It really is.
Thank you. You know, that introduction doesn't nearly say who you are, because you are so revered in this world of law, having played a major role in literally helping to write the law. So you are quite revered in this area, as well as for your many, many years of devotion to environmental law and public land law. So I consider ourselves extremely lucky to have you with us today. Well, let us start with what these treaties are. Why were treaties executed?
Well, it was well known back in Washington, D.C., that Chief Justice John Marshall had ruled that for the Supreme Court, that Indian tribes had an ownership interest along with the United States in all of their ancestral lands, and that it was impossible and illegal to homestead Western lands without having the tribes give their permission. Although that permission was often forced, in effect, but the nation was in this era in the 1800s of manifest destiny. It wanted to move all the way to the Pacific coast and settle all the Pacific coast, and it was mostly Indian land. And so the way that the nation went about it was not so much by wars. There were wars, but it was treaties with Indian nations that in which the tribes would transfer to the United States most of their land and retain reservations, and the land that was transferred to the United States could now be open for homesteading. Now, I want to emphasize that from the earliest days of the colonies, these questions came up, and there was universal agreement that tribes were governments, that they were sovereigns, and that the way you deal with sovereigns is not through MOAs or contracts.
MOAs being memorandums of understanding.
Yeah, right. Oh. Or contracts or memos or something. You deal with them by treaties. And so France and England did that. Spain did that. Portugal did that. And there was an understanding that tribes were nations, and so therefore treaties were the logical, proper, and widely accepted way of dealing with them.
But even then, as the treaties were being negotiated, was there not the recognition that the power equation was so lopsided that, in fact, the treaties were terms of surrender rather than genuine articles of sovereignty?
Well, that's close to it. But I would add this, that in many of the treaty situations, the tribes, in fact, had substantial military capability. And it depended on the tribe and the region and the time that it was done. In other words, the military capabilities tended to be much greater in the early years of the Republic and diminished as they were reduced to reservations. And so the very first Congress, four of the first 14 laws that our Congress passed were Indian laws. It was a major issue at that time. And the United States was very covetous about having the tribes ally with them against Britain and against France when disputes came up. So that there, first of all, was a time, particularly in the East in the early days, that the tribes were very significant militarily. Now, you say that, and I don't really object with the characterization that it was lopsided, but there's a factor here that does need to be looked at hard and understood, and that is the role of disease. And it was so horrible. Indian people did not have immunities from smallpox and other European contagions. And over time, Indian tribes lost 90% of their population to the diseases. So that the tribes that the United States was dealing with, the relationship was lopsided, as you put it, not maybe even primarily, but certainly not entirely, by just looking at military period. The reason if they were lopsided is that the tribes had been so reduced and so wounded, and the survivors often having been weakened, that the relationships necessarily were very different because of disease.
The basis of all nationhood is land. I learned that from my mentor, Professor John Henry Clark. And in this way, we have two agendas working, promulgated on the same recognition that the basis of nationhood is land. You had the United States in formation, and before the United States, you had other European marauders coming in looking to not only take land, but everything on it, under it, over it, around it, and in it. How did these two separate agendas meet in terms of treaties? How did they work these things out?
In which each sovereign basically wanted as much land as possible.
Yes.
To exercise its sovereignty over. I want to, and that's a great question, and I want to answer it first by doing a bit of foreshadowing, because think of this field, and you can definitely break it into smaller eras, and I do that myself. But for our discussion here, and generally, you've got to break this field into two very different time periods. One is the long time between the treaties and the modern era, roughly the late 1960s, in which tribes were steadily losing land, had almost no real world sovereignty. The Bureau of Indian Affairs was the real sovereign in Indian country, and it was a wet blanket, and the BIA controlled tribes. And then the modern era. And we'll come back to the modern era.
Yes.
But at the moment, and I want to stay in the past as you do, but I want to make it clear that the modern situation is very different. And tribes now are real governments, and they do govern their lands. And it's an area now of about 60 million acres, which is the size totally. This is outside of Alaska, by the way, where there are native lands. But in the lower 48, you've got 60 million, which is the size of a large western state like Colorado or Utah or one of the large western states. And those areas are owned and governed by Indian tribes in a serious way. And surprisingly and counterintuitively, the Indian land base is now growing steadily. And since the all-time low point in 1962 of 52 million acres, the tribes have increased that by 8 million acres net. That's an area 1.5 times the size of the state of Massachusetts that tribes have added to their reservations. And as we speak, there are tribal land offices that are processing more purchases, more acquisitions of land. And your point is so exactly right that sovereignty is related to land. Tribes are supremely aware of that. And that's why they're doing this. They are land-based peoples. They are determined to be increasing their land base and their sovereignty over that land base, and they are doing it. Now, that is not where we are standing at the moment in the mid-1800s when the treaties were going on.
What was happening then?
Well, then, as you put it, and I like the phrase you use, that the power quotient was lopsided. It wasn't 100-0. The tribes did have military capability. Both sides knew that the United States could overwhelm them by numbers. And again, because the tribes had lost so much to disease, and to some extent by technology. But when you get out on the edge of the frontier, for many of the treaties, the tribes outnumbered non-Indians in the area, and it would have been a matter of considerable expense and lives for the United States to go to war, so that the tribes did have some leverage at treaty time and in some cases negotiated important concessions.
Could you talk a bit, before we get closer to our current time, could you talk about the impact of slavery? Because this was one of the very important aspects of the power equation shifting with respect to the power of the First Nations many of them taking in slaves, many of them becoming sanctuaries for slaves, and therefore beefing up their military power to defend their sovereignty.
The pattern you're suggesting, which is accurate, was mostly in the South. And the northern tribes and western tribes were not really taking in slaves. But it did happen in the South. And in the South now, the Cherokees and the Seminoles and the Creeks and the Chickasaws were real rivals to the states in terms of power. And their reservations were large, and the states were really angry about this and didn't want a sovereignty within the sovereignty. They didn't want the tribal sovereignty within the state sovereignty. And also the issue you raise of some of those tribes taking in slaves and having, by the way, some of them their own slave economy, the tribes did, were further reasons why the South was angry. This was the build-up to the Civil War, and the early build-up to it. And Andrew Jackson was the all-time great Indian fighter. And by the way, Barack Obama is, people are beginning to say now as he's getting toward the end of his term, perhaps the greatest Indian advocate ever in the Oval Office. But Andrew Jackson was the worst, and he moved the tribes from the Southeast, where we had these conflicts with slavery being a big part of it, out to Oklahoma and other western areas, and this was the Trail of Tears, forced marches with rapes and murders and beatings along the way, and some of the marches going in the winter and people getting lost in high and cold rivers and drowned, and it was a terrible time. And so you had those powerful tribes, but not as powerful as the United States military that was willing to, Jackson was willing to fight whatever fight needed to be fought to get them out, and the tribes knew it, and they were marched west. And so that was a particular set of developments that was mostly regional and very dramatic. I mean, it was front page news and all that in the country, and followed closely. John Marshall followed it closely as Chief Justice and was appalled by it. But that did happen, yes.
Let's talk now about the devolving rights to the land through the treaty process. How did that come about? And could you talk about the evolution of that premise, that the land once won, there's an agreement that the United States would, the United States government will govern the land or manage the land. What was the phase that was worked out?
Well, again, I mentioned Chief Justice Marshall because his rulings have mattered so much, and they're still in place today. And he announced the law of the United States, which was that the sovereignty of tribes was recognized. And it was recognized not as some something lawyers cooked up. It was recognized because tribes were sovereigns, and before non-Indians ever came to the continent, they had laws, and they enforced those laws. They had judicial proceedings. They didn't call them courts, but they tended to be more like mediations, and but they're very interesting justice systems, and had some aspects to them that we're starting to use today. But in the majority system, but they were sovereigns, and so he announced that, and also announced the tribes' right to coming into the treaties, that they were landowners coming into the treaties. And that was accurate also, historically. So it really was a matter of the United States wanting as much land as it could get, the tribes wanting to keep as much land as they could keep. But the United States coming to the treaties, the negotiations, with a proposal of a drafted treaty in English, a language that Indian people did not speak or read, but it was translated. There were translators at the treaty negotiations, and there were plenty of cases where the tribes said, "That's too much. We're not giving up that much." And the United States would say, "Well, we're not budging." And so there were cases in which the initial U.S. proposal became the treaty. It remained what the United States wanted, they got. Other times, though, the United States said, just because of the balance of power at the time and calculating all the factors, including what the land was like, the United States would say, "Well, you say we have to knock off 50% off the amount we want, but we can't do that. We're not going to do that, but we'll knock off 25%. And so the tribes were able to obtain concessions in some cases in that way. Another kind of concession that the tribes developed, and this was something that they were prepared to go to war over, that the tribes were. And that was particularly in the upper Great Plains and the Great Lakes area, and most dramatically in the Pacific Northwest. They wanted to be able to continue to hunt and fish on the lands and gather vegetation, berries, roots, so forth, medicines, on the land that they were giving up to the United States, so that the tribe would have really two kinds of land rights. One, their own reservation, and secondly, the ability to hunt, fish, and gather on the lands they were ceding. And the United States did give that up. And today, right through today, the courts have enforced those off-reservation rights that are very important, and that in the Northwest resulted in an extraordinary ruling, very much in place today. The ruling came down in 1974 that the tribes are entitled to, under their treaty, the right to fish off the reservation, that they were entitled to 50% of all the salmon in the Pacific Northwest. And to this day, the tribes in Northwest Washington, the richest salmon area, and on the Columbia River, do have that right. So it was just the kind of we're so used to negotiations being in different fields where states in the United States argue over how broad the endangered species ought to be, over health care, and so many other things, that negotiations just develop and traditions develop, and that happened with the treaties in that particular context.
But we also have something that developed, and that was a voracious appetite on the part of the government and a sense of opportunity to make a lot of money based on exploitation of the land. And you mentioned Colombia, and we had done a series on the Hanford site, the nuclear mm-hmm. power plant that has polluted the air, the soil, and the rivers. And this is common in the land that the First Nations have under their jurisdiction, which they have a working relationship with, presumably with the United States. The idea was that, you know, the United States government would respect the land in the way that they did and still do. But what happened? When was this greed accelerated, and when did the United States become so mercenary about exploiting every single aspect of the land? We're now dealing with nuclear power plants, with mining and fracking and pollution and related environmental impacts such as, you know, cancer clusters and disease. Is there a period when this thing went completely out of control?
And are you talking about developments on reservations or generally?
On reservations.
Okay. I'd put it this way, and you use the word voracious, and the United States' appetite for land and control was voracious. And so the treaties got signed, promising that the tribes would own the land and that they would be recognized as sovereigns. And the United States proceeded to first not really recognize them as sovereigns, but to create the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which moved in and in fact controlled the reservation, so that if there was going to be a mineral lease of some kind or a coal-fired power plant, the tribe would have very little say over that, in fact, and the Department of Interior would just go ahead and make the decision. And that's contrary to the word and spirit of the treaty. And the other thing was that the United States proceeded to break most of the treaties in terms of the land there. And so, particularly beginning in the 1880s, you had a whole separate round of settlement of Indian lands in which the treaties were, the treaty land, a good parts of it, were open for settlement by non-Indians, even though it had been promised to the tribes in the treaties. And so the sovereignty and the land, the sovereignty promise and the land promise were just not kept. I mean, it's not some radical thing to say that. It's just true. The United States did not keep those promises. They violated the treaties. Then the change that you're asking about started in the late 60s. Let's say the mid-60s. And it was basically separate from the civil rights movement, but it benefited mightily from the civil rights movement, because what the tribes wanted, really, when you wash it all out, was a kind of separatism, a measured separatism, in which they would be the governments in Indian country and they would control the reservations, which again was the central promise in the treaties. And so you've had a modern tribal sovereignty revival and land, tribal rights revival, that can be spoken of in the same breath as the civil rights movement and the women's movement and the environmental movement. Tribes have made great progress. And so today, if a proposal comes in of the kind you're talking about, that goes to the tribal council. And the tribal council makes the decision on what sort of development there will be. We've seen some major fracking up in some of the North Dakota reservations, but by and large, the tribes have not bought into extensive development. They have created casinos under their own laws, not state laws. And have received significant revenues in some cases from those casinos. And they have approved some oil and gas leasing, and it depends on the reservation, but not that much when you look at it overall. And the tribes generally, I'm speaking generally, but I'm confident in it, they need to have economic development. Their unemployment is still high. They've brought it down a lot, really a lot, but it's still high. And there's still poverty out there. Depends on the reservation, But what the tribes really are looking for is some sort of economic development, yes, but hopefully just as clean as possible. And I think in many cases have been doing damn well at it.
Have they come to the point of seeing the logic of a common law among the First Nations?
Well, what they see is law within each tribe, within each nation. And there is an organization, the National Congress of American Indians, to which most tribes are members. But it's like the UN in that it is nations that meet together to try to achieve things for the common good of the world community, but don't cede or transfer their sovereignty to the UN. And so the tribes don't cede their sovereignty to National Congress of American Indians. They retain their sovereignty and work together on some things, but really not creating a universal set of principles, because the tribes are just too different for that. Just like states, nations in the UN are too different to have laws that are fully common to all.
The anomaly is that while there is poverty in the Navajo Nation, it's now about 43% living below the poverty rate, the median income $20,000 a year, and unemployment in the mid-40%. In some nations, it's as much as 80%.
Well, the overall average is in the mid-20s.
So here we have an anomaly. You have the land. You have all these things extracted from the land, the minerals, the oil, the fish and so forth, all these things that come from the land and the rivers and the environment. And you have all of this economic misery going on. So why is this happening?
Well, but you have to look at the trend lines. And the trend lines are in the opposite direction. And the really unrestricted development and obscene development occurred under the BIA, Bureau of Indian Affairs. And today, I'll take one example. Let's take oil and gas in the Southwest tribes, and there's a fair amount of oil and gas under reservations in Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona. The oil and gas was controlled completely by the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and the Bureau of Indian Affairs negotiated leases with companies, and they were for below market value. And so Indian oil and gas and coal was cheaper than was coal from nearby federal lands. It was just horrible, and there's no question about it. And this was part, by the way, of the recent payment that you mentioned at the top of the show to the Navajo Nation. It was unfair. And so, and again, imagine how difficult it is to change this system, but tribes have changed it. So that over a period of about 40 years, the tribes have gone from being entities that received royalties at below market value to companies that do their own oil and gas drilling on the reservations and sometimes off the reservations. And they are tribal entities, and the tribes don't receive royalties. They use the resource where the money is, where you produce it and can make a good profit. And so the tribes have made that change, and it's a huge change, because what you say was correct. There was just this rampant development, and by the way, the timber harvesting was horrible under the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And now the tribes control their timber harvesting. Many of them refuse to do clear cutting at all, which the BIA did mostly clear cutting up through the 1960s. And so, and also the trend line economically. I've pieced it together, and in the 1950s, the unemployment in Indian country seemed to be at about 60%. And now it's under 30%. I'm sorry, that's the highest in the country. That's horrible. But the trend is down and down and down. And you have more and more tribal businesses that where there's Indian hiring preference, and the tribes are improving. Many more Indian people going to college, with the tribes sometimes providing scholarships. The changes have been dramatic, and that doesn't mean there isn't a lot ahead of you. Movements break your heart. The civil rights movement, the condition it's in today, it breaks your heart. At the same time, there's been enormous progress. The women's movement, the environmental movement, they break your heart if you believe in them. At the same time, the amount of progress over 30, 40 years is very strong. And that's the way it is with Indian country today. They've come up legitimately a really long way, but there still is hard work ahead, and every single tribe knows it.
As a person intimately involved in writing the text of law, what, in your view, is the greatest challenge right now in terms of the law as it applies between the parties, the U.S. government and First Nations?
The way that tribes now participate in law is just so fundamentally different in the making of laws. If there's a bill introduced in Congress at this moment while we're talking, everybody in Indian country knows that by the end of the day. And it isn't just a technical matter of now we have the technology to have that happen. It is that the tribes are well organized and will very quickly assess that proposal, that bill that's been introduced, and decide what they're going to do about it, whether they're going to support it, whether they're going to defend it, and how hard they're going to support it, and how hard they're going to fight it, and how they're going to do it. And so the tribes are deeply involved in the legislative process, deeply involved in the Interior Department activities, State Department, elsewhere, and of course don't get everything they want at all, but they are involved in the process. Nothing takes them by surprise. And so now the question is what can be done. And To list a few things, and of course, we don't want to get policy wonky about it and go into it more than we should, but one big issue is taking land into trust, and this Supreme Court is just horrid on Indian affairs. You've got four justices who just will not rule for the tribes, and so if the tribes are in the Supreme Court, which had been very favorable to them for two generations, they've got to win 5 out of 5 justices is really what it comes down to in most cases. And they held put a big restriction on taking land into trust. And tribes, as I say, are purchasing land, and they want to take it into trust because that increases, in fact, the amount of sovereignty they have without getting into the details of it.
What is the concept of taking land into trust?
Well, the concept is that it becomes Indian country, And Indian country is the area within which tribal and federal sovereignty normally govern and state sovereignty doesn't. Whereas outside the reservations, outside of trust land, state law normally applies and tribal and federal law doesn't. So that's the area, the geographic reach of sovereignty is basically determined by trust land. Yes, that's a simplification, but it's basically true also. And so right now, with all these purchases that are being made, it's necessary to put land into trust, desirable for the tribes to put it into trust, and the government the court has made it difficult, more difficult to do that. So that would be an area. The situation in Congress right now, I don't think the tribes are worse off than anybody else. I mean, you cannot get anything through the House of Representatives. The Senate's better, not all that much better, but you can't get anything through the House. The tribes can't get anything through the House, although they've gotten a few things through, and so have other parties. But there's a stalemate there that hopefully for the good of the country will break. As I say, the Obama administration is very strong, has done a lot of things. It's been the Supreme Court in recent times that really has dealt the biggest blows to the tribes. Relations with the states are far better than they used to be. And the tribes are working hard to increase have really focused on Supreme Court practice and doing what you can do, which often means keeping cases away from the Supreme Court. The lower courts have been reasonably okay for tribes in recent years, but not the Supreme Court. So that's a big, big area, and a switch of one judge would make a big difference, depending, of course, on who the judge is.
To your mind, is race a factor in the way that the United States government historically has dealt with these First Nations?
Sure. The law is, and the law is accurate in this regard, that tribes are governments, and so you deal with them as you do with nations, the way you deal with Mexico, which and most nations, it's either ethnic or racial in character, but they're a nation, and so you don't think of them as a race, and that's true with tribes. But tribes, at the same time, there is a racial component here. And there are places where the racism is really bad. And you can list 8 or 10 places in the country that are just hot spots of racism against tribes. But I think by and large, I don't think they're just right now, for example, with the states, it's really very bald, and in that sense good, in that the states are sovereigns. They want to protect their sovereign interests. The tribes are sovereigns, and they want to protect their sovereign interests. And so let's sit down and negotiate and see what we can come up with. That's really the prevailing relationship with the states. Now, 40 years ago, when the tribes started flexing their muscles, the western states in particular, but also eastern states when tribes got active, were just against what the tribes were doing. And they'd go straight to court. And attorney general's offices in the states had Indian fighters, and they'd go straight to court. And now, I'm speaking generally, you go straight to negotiation. And it's arm's length negotiation, and you try to work it out. And it really is not a fundamentally racist situation. It's fundamentally trying to divide up governmental authority.
But still, the United States government has a critical advantage here in that it decides or it forces a decision on who is Indian.
I wouldn't put it that way. I'd say that the tribes all have membership roles, and they decide who's on them.
But to qualify for certain benefits of working with the U.S. government, even within treaties, they do have to decide whether they would admit that the U.S. government applies a standard, does it
no.
not?
No, well, yes, it does.
Indian.
And you know what the standard is? It's a person who's a member of an Indian tribe. Really, the U.S., I mean, there are places where the U.S. does decide on that, but it's very, very minor. I mean, the major thing is that all nations decide who their citizens are, tribes decide who their citizens are, and the United States accepts that. And so you've got hundreds of federal statutes where the word Indian is used, and then the definition in the statute is that an Indian is a person who's a member of an Indian tribe.
I was coming to the point of, in as much as there is this kind of movement now to assert its power and so forth, is there a parallel movement within these nations to affirm their cultural and racial identity?
Cultural identity, yes, is how they put it. And it's very powerful, and you've seen, and everybody who deals with tribes knows this, there's been a real revival of tribal traditions, cultural traditions. And so they're bringing back old dances, not powwows, which really are social dances, but the real traditional sacred dances. They're working hard to save the languages and have tribal schools where the language is used in the schools. That's a very tough area, but it's an example. I think we're going to lose some language. We've lost a bunch of languages already. I think we're going to lose more. But just about every tribe is determined and has some kind of language program to try to prevent that. You're seeing more painting, you're seeing more literature, you're seeing more art, weaving, a lot more weaving with people going out and gathering the materials that are necessary, songs. So yes, the culture you don't hear it described as racial. You hear it described as cultural. And actually, there's one reason there is that there is not there are a lot of similarity among tribes, but each tribe really has its own set of cultural traditions, and each one has a number of traditions that are essentially unique to how they do it themselves. And certainly when you go from one region to another, things are very different. The art's different. The dances are different. And so it really isn't racial in that sense. It is tribal.
Well, Professor Wilkinson, Charles Wilkinson of the University of Colorado at Boulder, this has been a fascinating conversation. I want to thank you so much for lending us your expertise here today, and hopefully we'll be able to come back to you again and follow up this conversation. But thank you so much for giving us an insight into First Nations and their sovereignty and U.S. land and treaty law.
Well, thank you, and I've enjoyed it very much. Your questions are very good, and you've worn me out. In a good way.
Well, thank you so much. We'll talk again soon.
Okay.
Thank you. And thank you so much for listening today. This brings us to the end of our program. I hope that was an illuminating a piece of information shared with you today to give you a background on, you know, sometimes you read a story, there's a big payout, there's a big settlement. Well, what's behind that? And then you start seeing the history of things, and you start connecting dots, and you start seeing that this didn't just fall out of the sky like a hailstone. It has a history, and it's a history that we're not thoroughly conversant with. So I hope that the conversation today helped us see some of the aspects that are hidden. So certainly you would want to stay tuned. Coming up next is Wake Up Call with Richard Martin. You can reach me via email at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Utrice Lead. And have yourselves a great weekend. Relax a little bit. Take it easy. We'll connect again on Monday. As they say, God willing, and the creek don't rise. And until then, thank you so much for the pleasure and great privilege of your company. We go out again with our artist of the day, Jim Pepper, with Lakota Song.